I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Almost everyone in Kansas City agrees that something here should be named after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The question is, what? Some advocates suggest the Paseo would be an ideal memorial. Others say an east-west running street like 63rd would be more appropriate. Today we'll discuss a recent recommendation that a new terminal at the airport be named after the late civil rights icon. Then, partisan fury has long been a theme in American politics, but has it finally gone too far? Pulitzer Prize-winning historian John Meacham, who joins me later, says American history has not always been noble, but we've still made a lot of progress. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Some black pastors in Kansas City are none too happy with the recommendations of a citizens group, which is suggesting that the city's new airport terminal be named after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. As a second idea, the citizens group recommended renaming 63rd Street after the civil rights icon. The pastors are standing by their proposal that it's the Paseo that should be renamed after King. The boulevard runs through the heart of the city's black community. Joining us now to talk about the recommendations is the Reverend Donna Simon. She's pastor of St. Mark Hope and Peace Lutheran Church and was the co-chair of the Citizens Panel. Reverend Simon, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Nice to be here.
Well, why did the idea of renaming the Paseo not rank higher on your list of recommendations?
Well, a couple of things. We conducted four hearings across the city. We heard a lot of different things from people. We did hear people come and say, we like the idea of the Paseo. We had almost an equal number of people come and say, we want something else. We had people that have a real attachment to the historical name, the Paseo, and to its generation out of Mexico City being named for the Paseo de la Reforma. We had young people. We actually added a little bit of time in between. We shortened our timeline to get the recommendation in order to go out and talk to the young people down at Carter Broadcasting that do the Generation Rap Show.
Right.
And surprisingly, what we heard from them was a strong feeling that the Paseo had a lot of historical associations in Kansas City, and it should be left the way that it is.
So what got you up to focusing on the airport then? Why did that idea have as much backing as it did?
You know, that idea came to us, I would say, almost out of left field. None of us, as far as I know, no one on the advisory group came thinking, hey, let's do the airport. And I would say that if not all, most of us had an idea that we might wind up with a recommendation that said Paseo. You know, none of us were opposed to Paseo. And I would not be terribly unhappy if this petition drive succeeds and it becomes the Paseo. But our task was to listen to people across the city and hear what they had to say. And we had people come and say, what about the airport? And then people stand up behind them and say, well, I got up to speak to 63rd Street, or I got up to speak to a monument. But, you know, the airport, that's an interesting idea.
Now, the mayor said the other day in the newspaper, he was very clear that you can't rename, if I understood him correctly, the entire airport complex after King, but only the new terminal. Am I seeing that correctly?
That is what the mayor said, yes.
Okay. And did your committee have a different idea about that?
Our committee, what we heard was airport. We would like to name the airport.
The Martin Luther King Kansas City International.
Yeah, we'd like it to be called the Martin Luther King Airport.
Yeah.
If they can name the terminal and the association with the entire airport becomes Martin Luther King, I think what matters is whether we're honoring Dr. King, not the mayor called it semantics, whether it's semantics or a kind of procedural question about whether we're renaming every street and every runway. You know, what we care about is that when people come into Kansas City, they see the name Martin Luther King.
Somewhere.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And that we have that association. It's big and it's bold, and it kind of snowballed, surprisingly, for us.
Towards the airport.
Toward the airport, yeah.
Are you surprised that you got into this, that this city did not have something named after King? Because the word before all this was, we're the largest metropolitan community in the country without a major street or a major something, I think I have this right, mm-hmm. named after Martin Luther King.
Well, it's always struck me as a bit of an oversight. I used to live in an apartment right off of Martin Luther King Drive in Berkeley, California. And, you know, I went to school in San Francisco. Have lived in a few places that yeah. have streets, major streets, named for Dr. King, and it seems like quite an oversight in Kansas City.
You also picked renaming 63rd Street after King as sort of a second place idea. What did you like about going that way?
So what people told us about 63rd and what we heard again from the young people in particular was that they liked the idea of something that crossed several communities in the city. That came all the way through 63rd runs from the east
Mission
side.
Mission Hills, Prairie Village, right? goes on and on.
Through yeah. Brookside, yeah. Into parts of town where we would love to see the name Martin Luther King lifted up.
Mm-hmm. Do you have get any feedback from communities on the Kansas side? Are they open to this? Do you have any idea?
Nobody, no. We did not reach out to other communities because it was beyond the scope of our work. We wanted to make sure to concentrate on having as robust and as widespread a conversation as we could.
So what happens next year?
So it went to the mayor, then it goes to the city council. It's up to them to wrestle with what they want to do. It's, of course, always up to citizens to continue to make their voices known mm-hmm. and say, you know, this is what we think it ought to be. Lots of people are coming forward with opinions about the airport. We actually heard no one in our process, no one spoke against the airport as an idea.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of people have an opinion now, and that's fine. And so it's up to the public to continue to, you know, folks want Paseo, continue to fight for Paseo. Let's do something.
How difficult was it for you guys to wrangle this steer to the ground? I mean, the idea of renaming something after King, I mean, it's the kind of thing that everybody's going to have an opinion on. So how difficult was the task as you set out to get this thing done?
The overall idea of it was simple. I'm sure there are people in this city that think we should not name anything after Martin Luther King. None of them came to speak to us. A couple of them posted on social media. I'm sure you'll find that shocking.
Yeah.
Social media is where we air all the things we wouldn't say in front of our mothers.
Yeah.
But the overall idea that Kansas City has some space to do a better job of honoring Martin Luther King fell easily on people. The question of narrowing down what it will be, you know, do we want to do Paseo? Do we want to do an east-west street? And this idea for the airport then came out of nowhere, and that took some time. We took a little time to wrestle with, what do we think of this? You
right.
had to sort of go, oh, the airport.
Yeah. And so again, where do we go from here?
Goes to the council.
Okay.
The council's got to figure out what, you know, I'm sure have seen that the aviation director has written a letter saying that he's not thrilled with the idea of changing the designation for the airport. And honestly, as we were talking about it, and again, it's outside of the scope of our work to think about the logistics
mm-hmm.
of the naming, but we were not thinking that the designation MCI would change.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in Kansas City calls it Kansas City International Airport already.
And when you go to get a ticket,
and when
it's
you go to get a
MCI.
Ticket, yeah, you better know it's MCI.
Yeah. So the city council will wrestle with this, and they're the ultimate authority here,
they
right?
They are.
Do you know what their timetable is?
I do not.
Yeah.
I don't know that they've set one yet.
And so you don't know when a final decision is coming down the pike here.
I don't. I don't think that they're going to want to stretch it out too long.
Okay. Well, that's the Reverend Donna Simon. She was co-chair of the Citizens Advisory Committee that wrestled with the renaming of a street or an airport after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Reverend Simon, great to have you here. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve. Lovely to be here.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with the prominent, eminent historian John Meacham about his new book that looks at sort of the history of America through the prism of where we're going and where we should be next. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we talked with mental health specialists who shared advice for talking about and preventing teen suicide. You can hear that conversation and others at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow on the show, local civil rights attorney Arthur Benson joins us to discuss recent legal cases involving freedom of speech, Medicaid funding, and of course, a famous school desegregation lawsuit here in Kansas City. Well, the presidency of Donald Trump has ginned up concerns over whether hope will ever again triumph over fear, whether our better angels will ever again overcome the divisions in America today. To that, Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian John Meacham points out, we've been here before. Lots of times, it turns out. This country has dealt with uprisings of extremism and racism before. The United States has long battled to deliver on the promises of the Declaration of Independence. But the hope is that, once again, the resilient spirit that has undergirded this nation from its founding, that has pulled the nation through challenging times before, is still with us. John Meacham talks about the history of this resilient spirit in his latest book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. He's the author of best-selling biographies of George Herbert Walker Bush, Thomas Jefferson, and Andrew Jackson. He speaks in town tonight, and what a pleasure it is to have him here. John, welcome to Kansas City.
Thanks so much.
This book is about hope triumphing over fear, and I'm wondering, to what extent is this book directed at our current president?
Almost entirely.
As a matter of fact.
I wouldn't have written it in the absence of the fundamental threat, I think, that the president poses to the constitutional norms and the dispositions of heart and mind that I think have pulled us through remarkably divisive periods in the past. It's not about Trump, but it is of the moment. And my own view, I'm not a partisan. I voted for Democrats. I voted for Republicans. Mm-hmm. I live in Tennessee, so my vote in the presidential election doesn't really count. Mm-hmm. Yours does.
Yeah, right.
But I think that a historically based view of what presidents and the populace of a given era have done suggests that if the president is out of sync with what we think of as our better angels, we can, in fact, pull him or endure, at least, these difficult periods.
He's out of sync, but he got elected.
He did. And I'd feel a lot worse if he'd won the popular vote. Honestly, it's an 18th century quirk that made him president. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean he's not a legitimate president. I don't want to say that at all. But he is, in many ways, the manifestation, the ultimate manifestation of a number of strains in the American character that are not unique but are perennial.
I was going to say perennial, even dating back to the founding of the country, when you talk about something as simple as racism.
Racism, which is the obvious and overwhelming one, also nativism. Mm-hmm. We, in the 1790s, gave the President of the United States power to deport immigrants by fiat, mm-hmm. in the Alien and Sedition Acts, the power to shut down newspapers. As recently as the Red Scare in the 19 World War I through 1920, the Attorney General of the United States and the Postmaster General under Woodrow Wilson closed down 400 newspapers,
yeah.
because they dissented. The McCarthy era of tyranny was about suppressing dissent and trying to create a vision of Americanism, mm-hmm. when in fact the strength of the country has always been that we have a broad canvas and any number of embodiments, any number of expressions of what it means to be an American.
But as you look back over the decades and the centuries now, what does it say about us, John, that we can't get past the racism thing? We can't deal with it. And we think of ourselves, I think, generally speaking, as way better than that.
We do think of ourselves as way better than that. And yet, you just mentioned Brown versus Board, I think, or alluded to it.
Yeah. Well, actually, a famous school desegregation case in Kansas City.
In Kansas City.
We spent tens of millions of dollars, and arguably, it didn't work. And that's our guest tomorrow is going to talk about that. Yeah.
And one of the things, and this is a tricky thing to say, so bear with me. 240 years is a long time, but it's not forever. And if we were reading about a historical developments 1,000 years ago, when we jumped from 800 to to 1,000, we wouldn't really think of it as all that long, particularly. Given the question of race, what Dubois called the problem of the color line, which defined the 20th century and in many cases defined America then and now, we have been making progress. Mm-hmm. It's slow, it's bloody, it's tragic. But 55 years ago, in my region, I'm a native Southerner, African Americans lived under functional apartheid.
Yeah.
I have in the lives of, lifetimes of many of your listeners,
yeah,
we lived in apartheid. Yeah. And does that mean now that we don't, we stop working? No. But it does mean that I think we can make more progress if we realize and just tell the story again and again that the country has become stronger the more widely we've opened our arms and the more generously we've interpreted the Jeffersonian assertion of human equality. The fact that Jefferson didn't apply it as fully as he should have, the fact that Abraham Lincoln didn't, does not mean that we can't. And in fact, that is the American journey. The American journey, which we will not be knocked off our course by any particular president. I'm as sure of that as I'm sure of anything.
Hmm.
And people have accused me of being hopelessly optimistic. But if you've come through slavery, if you've come through Native American removal, if you've come through denying women full access to American life, women have not yet voted for 100 years. Not 100 years. It's been 98 years since the amendment. When you think of it in those terms, I think you take a little bit of a deep breath. You don't relax. But you do, I think, then want to look back and figure out how did those folks get to higher ground and what can we learn from that?
The great historian John Meacham is our guest. His latest book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. And I should point out that John will be speaking this evening at 7 at Unity Temple on the Country Club Plaza. He'll be in conversation with the Washington Post, David Von Draley. To get a seat, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, that number 913-384-3126, or go on the bookstore's website. Again, 913-384-3126.
Can I say one thing quickly?
Yeah, sure.
And if you don't want to hear me, come listen to Von Draley.
Very good point. He's been here many times.
Von Draley wrote the single best piece on Donald Trump written. It was a cover story for Time magazine, the campaign. He linked the Trump phenomena to the disintermediation of everything. In terms of retail, in terms of communication. And if you read one thing about Trump, it's Von Draley's piece.
David's been known to do that, John. Yeah. You know, as we talk about the soul of America and this intense internal struggle that this country has been through, it may be embodied best, and you talk about it in the book quite a bit, in the man that we talk about a lot around here when it comes to presidential politics, and that's Harry Truman. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk in here about Truman's work on civil rights as an issue that did not come to him naturally, as it doesn't for a lot of people. In fact, he might have qualified as a bigot early in his life. And yet, as president, you write this, John, he saw his duty whole, as he put it in the book. What do you mean? And how does Harry Truman embody the soul of America, which is your premise here?
I think Truman and Lyndon Johnson are two of the great examples because they were able to take steps beyond their personal experience. They were able to overcome the limitations of their personal and political experience to lead us to higher ground. Both men were fundamentally affected by the fact of becoming president. Truman on April 12, 1945, Johnson on November 22, 1963. Truman's relatives, though this is a border state, were very much Confederate. They worshipped Robert E. Lee. They thought Abraham Lincoln was terrible. In fact, one of Truman's old relatives said, "I'll come to the White House, but if you put me in the Lincoln bedroom, I'll leave."
Mm-hmm.
So that was that was real in the 1940s. What Truman did is he reacted to experience. He was able to pay fidelity to, I think, the fundamental American insight, which is that reason has the capacity to shape our affairs as much as passion.
He was struck by a particular incident that really grabbed him that you write about.
It was a lynching, basically, in South Carolina. A newly discharged GI had just filed his papers, had gotten on a bus. in South Carolina, had been pulled off that bus by police and was then blinded by a nightstick wielded by a white policeman.
Truman couldn't believe it.
He said
it was happening in his country.
He said, "My God, I had no idea it was as terrible as that." And took steps. He commissioned the first significant civil rights report in presidential history, a report called To Secure These Rights. He was the first president to address the NAACP annual meeting. He did so at the Lincoln Memorial. There's a wonderful picture of it in
yes,
the book.
Yes, there is.
If you don't like the book, for the words, the pictures are great. and then he integrated the military, causing a fundamental shift and a crack up in the Democratic Party, which led Strom Thurmond to run for president and divided the 1948 electorate. There's a wonderful story. I think it's my favorite story in the book. Truman is at the White House.
It's right before the 48 election.
And he has a
confrontation here.
The executive committee of the Democratic National Committee has come to the White House. And a committee woman from Alabama stands up and says, Mrs. Thomas says, can I go back home and tell people, and I'm paraphrasing, that you're for, well, you have it there.
Yeah. I want to take a message back to the South, she said that day. That was her point.
That you're not just for the blacks, you're also for the whites.
Mm-hmm.
And Truman, wonderfully, pulls out a copy of the Constitution.
And starts reading it.
Reads the Bill of Rights. And he said, he finished, and he said, I'm the president of all the people, and these rights are my task, my duty to enforce. And he wasn't perfect. Into his late life, he thought Dr. King was a communist plant. He used words he shouldn't have used then and we can't use now. But as president, he did the right thing. And
he saw his duty whole. I love that line.
I think he did. And I think he once, in a wonderful collection of his post-presidential writings, he spent a lot of time dictating to secretaries with his reflections on things. He was talking about Andrew Jackson once, and he defined the presidency as well as I've ever seen it defined. He said that Jackson had looked after the little fellow who had no pull, and that's what a president is supposed to do. And that's what Truman was doing.
You know, your point in this book, John, is that over and over and over again, this country has rallied from times when fear and hate seem to dominate. I mean, how much do you worry that, you know, cynics might say that doesn't mean it's always going to happen?
Well, it doesn't. Nothing's foreordained. That's the nature of history. But you would have said the same thing if we had been sitting here 50 years ago today. 46 American servicemen died in Vietnam. That was the average daily casualty rate, not wounded, killed. Mm-hmm. That was a year that began with Tet, saw Lyndon Johnson get out of the race, saw the assassination of Dr. King, the assassination of Senator Kennedy, riots, the disintegration of the Democratic National Convention into violence. George Wallace won 13.5% of the vote and carried 4 or 5 states in November. I'd rather be dealing with Twitter than Tet. And again, the message, therefore, is not, hey, let's relax because we've come through it before. It's how do we come through these moments? And we come through them when we realize that the best way to guarantee fair play for you and me is to guarantee it for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Back to President Truman for a second. At the Truman Library in Independence, there's a document, his speech to the NAACP. I think it was June of 47.
The first time a president had addressed that organization?
It was. And this is what people like me live for, is it's called the manuscript files at presidential libraries, because it's anything a president touched, you get to see. Sometimes it's called the handwriting file. And the speech, he's on the fourth draft of the speech, typewritten in that classic sort of Smith Corona, you know, Underhill type face we all remember, or most of us remember. And he write in that wonderful handwriting of his, that spiky handwriting, he wrote on the speech, the speechwriter had said, and we must guarantee rights for all Americans. And Truman comes in and in that with a fountain pen writes, and when I say all Americans, I mean all Americans.
That's something Harry would say.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, you talk in the book about these different moments when presidents appealed to our better angels, and you cite any number of examples here. Let's begin with Ronald Reagan and what you said about Reagan's moment.
You know, President Reagan, in his farewell address, gave what I think of as one of the great definitions of why we are an immigrant country and why we have to continue to open our arms to immigrants. he said that he used as a trope that he had spoken of a shining city on a hill all his political life. Parenthetically, Ronald Reagan is the only man I know who can improve on Jesus. City on a hill is the phrase from the Sermon on the Mount. Mm-hmm. And John Winthrop, who used that in his sermon coming over in the 17th century, said, "We shall be as a city upon a hill." Reagan made it a shining city on a hill. Mm-hmm. I said that to Mrs. Reagan once. I said, President Reagan improved on Jesus. And she said, "Well, yes, that's the kind of thing Ronnie did."
She didn't blink.
May we all be loved as Nancy Davis loved Ronald Reagan. But anyway, so he's describing what the shining city is like. And he says wonderfully in a line written by Peggy Noonan, but coming from Ronald Reagan's heart, that we had to always be open to all the pilgrims from all the lost places hurtling through the darkness toward home.
Yeah.
And that's a big-hearted vision of the country. People don't like Ronald Reagan for all sorts of reasons, but I got to say, in the present context, he looks more and more like Cicero.
Mm-hmm. You also pointed to a really interesting moment involving President George H.W. Bush, whom you have written a book about. This moment's, for our times today, an interesting moment.
About gun violence.
Yes.
It was April 1995, and Oklahoma City had just been attacked, 187 casualties, including a number of children. And the NRA was raising money. Surprise, surprise. And they referred to federal agents, in an allusion to both, really to Ruby Ridge, as jackbooted thugs. And somehow or another, this letter reached President Bush's desk in Houston. And he wrote a letter to the NRA saying, resigning as a life member, saying that it violated his concept of service to country, that mm-hmm. federal agents were incredibly important and devoted public servants. And he simply could not be part of an organization that would speak that way about those sworn to uphold the Constitution.
And that's taking aim at a key element of his own constituency.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a useful reminder that presidents, and this is, if I had 3 minutes with President Trump, this is what I would say. We know you care about success. We know you care about ratings. But history is a lot longer than any given news cycle, any given Twitter cycle. And what history tells us is that the presidents we remember fondly, the presidents we commemorate, the presidents we want to emulate, are the ones who reach beyond their own base of supporters or who stand up to those in their base of support who are on the wrong side of history. One of the tragedies of this era.
A lot of critics would say they don't sense that President Trump would be capable of going that way.
There's not a lot of evidence right now, but intellectual honesty compels us to say that there's always hope
mm-hmm.
because no one can do it until they do it. There was a moment, I don't know if you remember this, a couple of months ago, right after the Parkland shootings, where there was a meeting with the congressional leadership in the cabinet room, and Mike Pence was across the table from the president. Dianne Feinstein was sitting to his left, appropriately. And Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania is at the end of the table. And Pence is giving kind of the NRA talking points. And Trump has arms crossed. And he said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do blah, blah, blah. And he laid out this fairly common sense gun reform list of things to do. And he points down to Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania. And remember, James Carville once described Pennsylvania as Pittsburgh and Philadelphia with Alabama in the middle. And he said to Pat from Pennsylvania, he said, "We're going to get that in the bill, right, Pat?" And Toomey looks as though he's been kicked in the head. And Diane is clapping excitedly.
Completely unexpected from this president.
Totally unexpected. And of course, he reversed himself. But the moment there was a sign of what might be. And there is this perennial American fantasy that we will elect someone president who will not be tethered to the existing interests and will do the right thing. I'm not wildly hopeful about that, but history tells us that we should, as President Bush once said, watch and learn.
Yeah. Historian John Meacham is my guest. His new book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. I'm going to go back to George H.W. Bush for just a moment here, because speaking of him, didn't Barbara Bush once mistake you for the writer John Grisham?
Well, not quite.
Something like that?
Very, very quickly. years ago, I was at the National Book Festival on the Washington Mall, and a woman ran up to me and said, "Oh, my God, I just love you so much. I admire your work. "Well, you wait right here. I'm going to go buy your new book." And I was standing there thinking, "This is exactly the way the world should be. Women, women should run up to you. They should admire you. This was great." And she brought back John Grisham's latest book. And so
it wasn't Barbara Bush.
It was not Mrs. Bush. But the next day,
okay,
this is the story I told.
Yeah,
at her funeral. The next day, I was on my way to Maine. I was writing the book about the president at the time, and we were at lunch, and I told the story, sort of waiting for some kind of motherly reassurance. And Mrs. Bush looked at me and said, "Well, how do you think poor John Grisham would feel? You know, he's a very handsome man." I was like, "Gosh, you know." So I was 0-2. But that's the story.
I assume she was joking, John.
I hope
because
so.
Because there is a little resemblance.
But
John's here before.
May I say, I haven't had a chance to report this very widely. I got an email from John Grisham about 5 days ago saying that I told that story at Mrs. Bush's memorial service. And he said he's worried about his readers because his wife had just received a sympathy note because they thought I was speaking at his funeral. So it's a story that won't end.
To set the record here. Yeah, that's right. Let's go back to Truman for a moment because I thought this quote from him was fascinating from the book again. He once said this, "You never can tell what's going to happen to a man until he gets to a place of responsibility. You just can't tell in advance whether you're talking about a general in the field in a military situation or the manager of a large farm or a bank officer or a president. You've just got to pick the man you think is best on the basis of his past history and the views he expresses." That's a fairly, all at once, a sobering assessment and a pretty powerful reminder too, isn't it?
It is. And it's very common sense. It's very Truman-esque.
Yeah.
And he goes on in that to say, you got to hope. And if you're inclined that way, do a certain amount of praying.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was true in his case. You know, there were a number of GIs around the world in that tumultuous hour on the eve of VE Day, when we thought we were going to have to invade the Japanese home islands, who didn't know who Harry Truman was,
mm-hmm,
when the news came from Warm Springs that FDR had died. And he rose to that occasion. I think to some extent he was talking about himself.
And there, that great quote in the Oval Office that day, "Boys," he said, referring to the press corps there, "I feel like the moon and the stars and have all fallen on my shoulders." You know, only Truman would have said something that honest, that candid,
exactly,
in a moment like that.
Exactly. And when he'd been drinking bourbon with Sam Rayburn when he became president. He didn't know it. And Mrs. Roosevelt summons him to the White House. And he walks in. He says, "Well, is there anything we can do for you?" And Mrs. Roosevelt said, "No, Mr. President, the question is there anything we can do for you? For you are the one in
trouble now."
Now.
Yes, absolutely. Is this book ultimately, John, a call for the type of liberalism that once was a dominant part of our politics and
no,
now seems to have faded away?
No, it's not. I'm not a liberal. I'm not a movement conservative either.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect I'm where a lot of folks are, which is, I believe that there are some great ideas that have come from the Reagan-Bush wing of the Republican Party. I think there are good ideas that have come from the Clinton-Obama parts of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And I believe that neither party has a monopoly on virtue or on truth. And there is the American consensus. We talk a lot about that, and people tend to think, "You mean liberalism?" But really, the last three quarters of a century in the United States have been determined by what I would call a consensual conversation, figurative, not literal, between Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan. And the question has been, to what extent does the state have primacy of place, and to what extent does the marketplace have primacy of place?
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere between those goalposts, the country has been for 75 years. We are in an uncertain moment where that conversation has stopped, at least in terms of the president as a participant, and we don't really know what's replacing it. And perhaps that conversation gets picked up again after this moment,
mm-hmm,
perhaps that conversation is over. But that's the consensus that I do think, and I would like to see us go back to, is if you have a field of endeavor that's defined by the New Deal versus the Reagan Revolution, then, you know, that's the conversation that created immense wealth, the Civil Rights Movement, the victory in the Cold War,
mm-hmm,
and an extraordinary ability for millions upon millions upon millions of people to pursue happiness. And I hope that conversation is one we can return to.
You know, for those who are in despair out there about the state of affairs in America today, you actually offer some advice. Mm-hmm. And the first piece of advice you offer is to simply engage.
You've got to be in the arena. And it's exhausting, my Lord.
Politics is a contact sport.
It's all of us. A republic is only as good as the sum of its parts. Our dispositions of heart and mind, yours and mine, the folks listening, matters enormously because the nature of self-government is that it takes its character ultimately from the people. Yes, different interests take over for a given amount of time. Yes, they stop particular reforms. Yes, the president is at best wildly unconventional and at worst has declared war on the constitutional norms. But the Constitution itself was written for seasons like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's a human document. It takes into account our appetites and ambitions and sinfulness. And
the notion that one person can't blot out the sun, essentially.
Exactly. And there was a 19th century political scientist who said that Americans had essentially revived the oldest form of government, the elective kingship. And that's certainly been true in the nuclear age. All eyes focus on the presidency. But that was also true. John Adams wrote that the first character, meaning the president, would be the subject of all eyes and all conversation. So there was an awareness from the beginning of the centrality of the office, though it has grown immensely in power. My plea to people is stay in the arena. Try not to be tribal. Mm-hmm. Try not to pick a team and then just not listen at all.
To the other side.
Mm-hmm. And 99, and this is not a call for the Brookings Institution to run America. I'm not saying that the truth is always in the middle. The truth, sometimes one side has the truth and sometimes the other does. But 99 times out of 100, even if we disagree, I bet on that 100th, the other side may have some light to shed.
John Meacham's new book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. Again, you can see and hear him tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. To grab a seat, just call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. What a pleasure to have you, John. Best
Honored
of luck to
be
to
here,
you.
And I hope Von Drehle does well tonight.
I do, too. keep an eye on him for us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll learn about the Poor People's Campaign. They're looking to combat poverty, racism, and environmental damage in Kansas City and throughout the country. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.